indeed by this legislature, and I believe that's no exaggeration. The reason I think that is true is because to a much greater degree even than many members of the legislature are aware, the budget development process in exec and in the agency has become benchmark driven. See those of you who sit on appropriations will have seen certain agencies highly favored, certain agencies not highly favored, depending on how they stack up in the world of benchmarks. Anyone that doubts that can verify by talking to the people at exec. They take those very literally, and they have tremendous weight. One of the most important things I think that this body can do is to assist those that have fewer tools at their disposal in impacting the benchmark development process to do so. That will have a real and tangible benefit in the shape of the budget that emerges from exec before it goes to the legislature. I think it's extraordinarily important. With regard to the fiscal impact of this bill, most of that shows up in the LFO budget, and that's down from a humongous figure that was quoted over on the Senate side. I think it is still vastly exaggerated. What I would urge this committee to do in its deliberations is to make it clear on the legislative record that the development of the human impact statement would occur as part of the same documentation process that the agency uses to develop the fiscal impact statement, so that there is not a separate paper trail created. That's what would create the administrative cost. But if they do it at the same time, Vicki Gates at DHR has assured me that essentially there's no extra cost. And then you have what extra cost there might be from it being retyped onto LFO stationery, and I think that's reasonably minimal because that's basically the approach that's with some oversight that's used in LFO. I again think that this is a very good piece of legislation. I think it'll give the legislature some good new tools. With regard to funding, my suggestion would be that you do try to encourage some private sector contributions. I can assure you that the Oregon Healthcare Association and other similar groups would perhaps not write a big check, but would be prepared to step up and help this process along.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an excellent description of what's in plan, so that when we get these, you turn over here and it says on page 2, there's a bold face that says human impact statement, you know, and it's right there. It tells whether you're making progress towards a benchmark or you are receding from the benchmark.
Precisely.
Based on what's above, and it's not some separate hoo-hoo with an office and stationery and supplies and all that jazz and phone numbers and et cetera, but rather a new responsibility or duty to be discharged by our present staff.
Precisely.
So that's the way to go, and that's the way we ought to get ahead in order to cut it down. And then if we also want to open it up for some contributions from the affected parties or foundations or...
Greg Meyer.
Yeah, all those folks. Maybe the thing to do is run down the children's impact statement and put it into this.
Mush it in. That's what I would say.
Mush it in.
Yeah.
And put them together and have one and not be funding two.
Yeah. Particularly if you're going to go the reinventing government route, look for results. You know, you should articulate what those are going to be.
Yeah, we should. I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't move so fast on that impact, the children's impact statement. But who knows? It's gone. It's over in the House. There it is.
On its way. Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes, one other comment. Correct. You might want to talk to legislative fiscal about this, too, because anything dealing with impact studies, they have some concerns, and
I know they do.
Fit it into their...
They really don't. If they do, if the thing is emerges from DHR, they've already got this information. This is the information they use to generate the fiscal impact statement. It's simply a matter of articulating it. It shouldn't be much, if any, work for LFO.
That's right. Okay, thank you very much. And if there's no one else to be heard on Senate Bill 1030, we will close the hearing. Senate Bill 1030. And going next to House Bill 2307.
Did you get down the amendments which were offered by Mr. Shekinoff?
Yeah, I've
done.
Yeah. And I've got, here, you can tell from the markup that the quick look, but I'll get them put together.
That'd be good.
Yeah. And I also have,
Yeah.
What would you say the next bill was? What would you?
2307. Let's see.
How would I do with
you have 2307? Okay, oh, no. Yeah. We're having the work session.
Where's 2307?
We're back. This is the work session on Senate Bill 2307. This is a bill that we acted on Monday to amend regarding the use, the inclusion of age as a factor which may not be included in restricted covenants in the conveyance of real property. There was some feeling that that, what we did, the way in which we amended the bill may have been too sweeping in the sense that it would have eliminated senior plan communities. At the request of Senator Cairns, these amendments that are before us now have been drafted, and what they would do would be to restrict the use of the term age in the conveyance of real property so that it would be permissible to set age as a criteria in situations of planned communities or in cases where housing has all persons of 62 years of age or older, or at least 80% of the households in the housing area are headed by someone 55 years of age. Now, this language that's before us in the amendment is the same language that is used in the Federal Fair Housing Act, which Congress ran into the same kind of difficulty.
And these are the amendments of May 24th?
These are the amendments now that are dated May 26th.
26.
And that's this right here. And this is the amendment.
Okay, Senator Cairns, you want to speak?
Yeah, no, that's fine. It gets to where we want to be, I think. I think that it simply says that you've got a reasonable exclusion for places where there is 100% of an age class or 62, or they meet the other definitions regarding planned adult community and et cetera, and I don't see any reason why we can't accept that as an amendment. So
okay, then you wanna,
that would be my motion.
Okay. Senator Cairns moved then the amendments of May 26, 1993 to House Bill 2307. Is discussion?
As I recall, was this the bill that Senator Representative Bryan's LA was here?
Right.
And what was his concern?
Exactly this, that this amendment deals with. The way we amended the bill last Monday would have been a blanket prohibition against the use of age in real property conveyances. That would theoretically do away with the possibility of creating senior plan communities and limiting the property owners to those of a certain age group or not. We went and talked to Representative Bryan, and he has no problems with this language, which would preserve those senior plan communities, but otherwise, outside of that, would restrict the use of age as as a covenant term.
It's the King City Amendment.
My other concern then dealt with covenants, codes, and restrictions that are frequently used in subdivisions.
Go right ahead.
Subdivisions where it says that the, you know, you can't have farm animals, you can't have old junker cars, the house has to be used as a single family residence. Are we expanding an existing law that was passed, I think, the last legislature that said that CC&Rs that have provision dealing with single family residents are overridden by this new statute that says that those can be placed in those residential areas?
Yes. As I understand it, we are. We're saying that those covenants notwithstanding, you can't have a you can't have a bar to placing such a zoning in a single family residence in a zone single family residence neighborhood if it is not a, the only place you couldn't would be in a senior planned unit development. So it would set aside that covenant, as I understand it. Is that correct, Mr. Merriman?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, so that you could go ahead and put one of those in, but then I could come along and buy the property from you and then take in 3, 4, or 5 persons in an adult foster facility. And you could not enforce a covenant against it.
Thank you.
Simply saying that it's a statutory override of the NIMBY effect as included in covenants. NIMBY covenants, we're simply saying you can't have one for this purpose. You can have them for junker cars, and you can't park your RV out in front on the street, and you can't paint your house flamingo pink, and you can't have various satanic icons on it, and every other thing else you want, but people who need adult foster care have a right to have that, and it's you can't say that they can't exist anyway. So that's what it does.
I thought we had a due pass on this already.
No, we worked on it. We had some problems with it. We didn't get it out of committee, did we?
No. Nope. Yeah.
Did we?
Yeah.
Yes, we saw the committee.
We did. We're reconsidered.
Oh, well, let me through first. For,
it's not a committee.
Yeah, the chair would move that we reconsider the vote by which we sent House Bill 2307 for the due pass recommendation. Is there objection? Thank you. Now we're legal. No, the answer is yes, we did. But upon doing that, we found that it was much too sweeping. And that's simply saying age by using age as a saying you couldn't discriminate on that basis was so overbroad that it would have caused lots of problems and probably run into real trouble on the other side. The problem is, as you can see the new language here, we're simply saying that you can't restrict them use on the basis of age unless planned community in your state or housing where all the persons are over 60 years old already is the 55 and over adult community. So you can discriminate based on age in those places. And that apparently passes muster. Although I'm not sure it passes muster in this committee at the moment.
I have a problem because with...
give me the agenda. I don't have an agenda.
With the CC&Rs, I think if you buy a home in a residential community and you buy it based upon those CC&Rs, I have a problem with legislature overruling those unless it violates some discriminatory code. And this isn't a violation of it. And there are other areas in the community that don't have the CC&Rs where the foster home can be located. So although it sounds like a NIMBY rule, it's a NIMBY rule where there are other alternatives. So I'm going to vote no on the bill.
Well, we're not voting on it right now, so... I can count to three, and I can't do it at the moment. So, all right, let's move along to go back to the top at 7:50. Want to do that one?
Yeah, let's do that one.
Okay. I think we got this one fixed up.
How long will it be here?
We got this one all fixed up. Do you like that, by the way, Senator Kuhl? I didn't ask you. 2307 is amended. You're all right on that one?
As amended?
Yeah.
Are we going to refer this to Ways and Means for the 100 grand?
No. This is one on the foster, adult foster.
No idea. Yeah.
You voted for it the first time.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with that. Yeah.
Okay, well then, we're in work session then, and the other further discussion on the question of House Bill 2307. Is there objection to the adoption of the amendments? Is May 26th, House Bill 2307. Hearing none, so ordered. And then further discussion, if not, then let's call the roll of the chairs by my motion to send House Bill 2307 as amended to forward with the pass recommendation.
Senator Bryant?
No.
Senator Cooley?
Aye.
Senator Cairns?
Aye.
Chair McCoy?
Aye.
That's a winner. Got one down. Give that back to the chair. And we turn to Senate Bill 750. Just about to open the file.
Okay. Mr. Chairs, Senate Bill 750 was before this committee earlier. It prohibited effectively the placement of advertising of tobacco products in public facilities. We heard testimony to the effect that there might be constitutional difficulties with it. We got an opinion from legislative counsel that said indeed there were constitutional problems, and that opinion suggested some options to us. One option was to amend the bill to encourage public bodies in the state not to enter into agreements or contracts to advertise tobacco products in the public facility. And an amendment has been prepared that follows that course of action and changes the bill to make it an encouraging bill.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Cairns.
A number of witnesses came before us, and I think Mr. Gardner alerted us to the question of the more narrow, or I'd say more restrictive, First Amendment of the Oregon Constitution, which bars virtually all limitations on commercial speech as opposed to what is permitted under the U.S. Constitution, and we're searching that. We have a May 13, 1993 Legislative Council letter to us that says the answer is in, does the Oregon Constitution prohibit the prescription described in Senate Bill 750? Their answer is short and sweet, we believe it does. And then they go on for at quite some length to tell us why that is, and I don't think it can be overcome by anything that we could say here. So my suggestion would be that we simply send to the folk out there a message that we want to discourage, if we can, by all means constitutional, the advertising of tobacco products in public facilities. And that's really all the amendment does, and it does it, I think, in solid, clearly solid, granite-like constitutional foundation. So I don't know whether there are those who wanted to take a moment or two to respond to that, but it would seem to me that would be a fairly safe thing to do.
Okay.
And also the May 26th amendment also corrects one mistake, one error in the whereas. Look at all these good things. I see the ACLU out there. They don't agree with my constitutional analysis of that. So.
Okay. Let's. Does anybody want to speak to the issue.
Two of them.
Multiply before your eyes.
A majority and a dissent.
Mr. Nelson, Ms. Gardner. Anybody?
Mark Gardner has empowered me to speak on his behalf.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Go right ahead.
Oh. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm David Fidanke, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. With me is Janet Ahrens, our Associate Director. The language that Senator Cairns has put forward, we believe, would also be unconstitutional. It may be less unconstitutional, but we don't think it's going to matter much.
Less unconstitutional.
We're doing the best we can.
First of all, blow a hole in this game. This one puts a rifle shot. That's okay.
Exactly. The problem is, of course, that local governments have the same constitutional restrictions that this body does in terms of making content-based decisions on the basis of the content of the speech. And so the constitutional provision that would prevent this body from enacting the original bill, we believe, would also prevent local governments from failing to renew contracts because of the content of the advertising involved.
There was an incident in Portland about a year and a half.
Speak your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Janet Ahrens with the American Civil Liberties Union. And by the way, it's a pleasure to appear as a constituent of yours in front of you again.
Well, thank you.
There was an incident in Portland about a year and a half or 2 years ago where an entertainer by the name of Andrew Dice Clay came to Portland and incensed several members of the city council. The city council wanted to follow a strategy employed by Senator Cairns, the big hole theory, where they would simply not allow the public body, the Civic Center, to enter into a contract with him for his performance. And when the constitutional issue was raised, they employed Senator Cairns' second small hole theory, where they issued a resolution pleading with the citizens of the city not to purchase tickets to support Andrew Dice Clay because of his sense of humor and how it impacted women and people of color. We found both those moves unconstitutional and don't think that this kind of a mandate that would require communities to encourage judgments based on the content of speech be appropriate or constitutional.
Mr. Chair? Yeah, Senator Cairns.
Does governments have a right to speech? Do people who are in government have a right
sure.
to speech? Do they? If they find something which is a clear question of going to the very core of the purpose for government, and governments are organized to protect and defend the health, safety, and welfare of the people. And tobacco use by the individual and those who share the same airspace with those who are using tobacco products find that their health, safety, and welfare is impinged by that activity, and that government should do everything in its power without running through the Constitution, try and alert all other governments and through them, the public, about the dangers. And that if we can't speak about this, what speech can we use regarding this? How should we go? Should we pass a law that says no government having control over a public facility that is leased to the public or to private entities permit any advertising of any sort in that? Would that be good enough?
Chair McCoy, Senator Cairns, the U.S. Surgeon General's warning that's applied to advertising and to cigarette packages is a good example of applying constitutional rights of public entities to speak on behalf of safety concerns and issues where they're countering one kind of speech with another kind of speech, where they're providing warnings and education.
How about if we were to say that in all public facilities where you have tobacco advertising that based upon the square footage of it, there shall be a flashing neon sign flashing one of the variants of the Surgeon General's warning regarding tobacco. Would that be satisfactory to give equal time? And in fact, it wouldn't be in the space purchased by the tobacco company. It would be below and adjacent to. And in fact, we could move it somewhere else in the auditorium altogether so that when they speak about tobacco, there might also be a message up there flashing the Surgeon General. Could we link them in that way and require public entities to provide equal time for speech?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cairns, I'm not sure that you could require it only in the case of tobacco advertising. You could certainly encourage local governments to provide, if they make a decision to allow for tobacco advertising, to encourage them to have equivalent space set aside for advertising the dangers of the use of tobacco. That, in fact, is how tobacco advertising was taken off television. It was tobacco companies that wanted it taken off because the FCC ruled it for equal time purposes, and under the fairness doctrine, there needed to be public of public service announcements advertising the dangers of.
How about if we were to draft this then to be an equal time and say for every, say 50% for every 100 square feet of advertising is 50 square feet dedicated to the evils and problems of tobacco. I mean, if you got the Marlboro man up there, and you know, on the hoardings around the rodeo, maybe somewhere up there, we have another one that says, kissing a smoker is like licking an ashtray. Or something else. sort of an equal time deal.
Senator Cairns, I think
so there'd be lots of voices in the marketplace. You're off the
problem. The problem is if the distinction is made to have this other advertising only in the case of tobacco advertising, it would be considered to be content-based, however you did it.
Okay.
If you had a provision that, again, that encouraged local governments to do something or that said it was framed in terms that were content-neutral, for example, you could say something like, if a public body determines that particular type of advertising
or product
would
advertise.
Product advertising would add to dangers to the public health, it shall take steps to put information in front of the public that alerts the public to that danger. Something like that that didn't specifically single out one type of.
So that we've got, you know, it's but Miller time, or this bud's for you, then you're going to have something up there that says warning, you know, during pregnancy you shouldn't be drinking and that can lead to addiction and et cetera. So those kinds of
things. Maybe a warning that men in attendance to sporting events shouldn't have more than one hot dog a year.
Why is that?
Because of the health risks of the food products at the concession stands.
Well,
whatever floats your boat.
I think the point, Mr. Chair and Senator Cairns, is that in order for a statute or a regulation by a local government body to pass constitutional muster under the Oregon Constitution, it's going to have to be aimed at the effects of the speech rather than the content.
Right. That was the.
So if it were framed in terms of the effects that would be created.
Yeah, well, how about, Mr. Chairman, how about if we task the able representatives of the ACLU to bring us back a content-neutral amendment which would provide some language to give some equal voice regarding, and leave it to the local officials. If the local officials want to be stampeded by the folks are concerned about the content of a hot dog and want to speak about the need for a, you know, high fiber, you know, diet and avoidance of meat byproducts and pig snouts and the rest of it, and shouldn't be eating that, then that's fine, too. I'm not going to chase that one. But for the ones we can easily identify, of alcohol and tobacco, I think are pretty clear. Something that would speak to things generally recognized, which the Surgeon General has, you know, used that kind of language. Products which are advertised in the marketplace, which the Surgeon General has identified, can lead to addiction and, you know, et cetera, and so forth. Can you play with that and come back with something?
We can certainly try, Mr. Chair, Senator Kearns.
Yeah.
You're not going to.
I don't know if anybody else got any questions, but I mean, rather than coming up and throwing, you know, I don't think you want to spend your entire session coming by and saying, we don't like that. Maybe we can find one that you can draft. That you can say, this works, and we'll all salute, and out it'll go.
We'll sure take a try at it.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on this 750 who have some ideas about improvements?
Anyone else that wants to float their boat?
Float their boat.
My name is Brenda Niblock.
For this bill, and what I believe is a is a satisfactory conclusion. What I'm passing out now is a copy of ORS 197663. And I'll briefly tell you how this problem has developed. You will note that 197663 deals with zoning residences, and I would take you to the next page, the second page, to 197663. Sub 4, which says, to meet the growing need for residential homes and residential facilities, it is a policy of this state that residential homes and adult and residential facilities shall be considered a residential use of property for zoning purposes. Sub 5 is a policy of the state to integrate residential facilities into the communities of this state. The objective of the integration cannot be accomplished if residential facilities are concentrated only in one area. Finally, in 197665 sub A, it states any residential zone, including a residential zone which allows a single family dwelling, or it says residential homes shall be permitted use in any residential zone, including a residential zone which allows a single family dwelling. Finally, in sub 2 there, a city or county shall not impose any zoning requirement on the establishment and maintenance of a residential home in a zone described in subsection 1 that is more restrictive than a zoning requirement imposed on a single family dwelling in the same zone. Clearly, the legislature, when they adopted the entire system of adult foster care, meant for these facilities to be integrated into the communities and into the neighborhoods in which they remain. We have, over the last 5 or 6 years, have come across on individual basis in different counties building code, utility code, kinds of standards and requirements that tend to treat these houses differently than single-family dwellings. So we've wrestled with what you now see is A and Gross 2305 in an effort to try to meet the needs of building codes and fire marshal concerns as well as the needs of adult foster homes. And you will note in House Bill 2305, it states at first adult foster homes that are certified as residential homes shall meet all state and local building, sanitation, utility, and fire code requirements applicable to single family dwellings. However, by rule, the Department of Human Resources may adopt more stringent standards upon a finding that there is a significant health or safety threat to residents that necessitates a standard not imposed on other single-family dwellings. In adopting the standards, the department shall consult with the building codes and the state fire marshal. And then we say, as used in this section, adequate evacuation, consult with the Office of State Fire Marshal to ensure adequate evacuation of residents. And then we say, as used in this section, adequate evacuation means the ability of the provider to evacuate all residents from the dwelling within 3 minutes. So what we've done is say that the local building, sanitation, fire code shall be applicable to adult foster care as they are applicable to single-family dwellings, unless the Department of Human Resources finds that there is a significant health or safety threat to residents. Example, and this is part of the rules of SDSD, is you cannot have any internal locked doors. We believe that that, and of course in a single family dwelling, you can have internal locked doors. But the division has determined that that is something which poses a threat to the individuals. Same thing with the 3-minute fire evacuation rule. So in working with this language in the House, we have received the concurrence of both the building codes division as well as the fire marshal fire marshal's office, who is here today.
Okay. Mr. Underwood, you
My name is Gary Underwood. I'm the Bureau Manager of Fire Prevention, Office of State Fire Marshal, and I'm representing Susan Browning, the State Fire Marshal, in support of House Bill 2305. And I do this because when the bill first started out, it was not the way that we wanted it. Because of the amendments that have been made, it is now appropriate because we feel that there is a concern about the evacuation of elderly people in single-family residence, and because we have the greatest number of fires in single-family residence and the greatest number of deaths, we do have this concern. Now, since the amendment that says they must be capable of evacuating in 3 minutes, which is a national concept for evacuation of buildings, we would support this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Do you have anything else to say, Mr.?
And I think it's been covered very well. There's an interesting background on how this thing started over 4 years ago with the concept of treating adult foster homes no differently than single family residences. And Senator Otto carried a bill for us for two sessions ago regarding electrical inspections, and that's where the concept really got started, and this is the outgrowth of all of those 4 years of work. I think it's been well covered.
Okay. So if there's no further questions?
Let me ask one thing.
Yes, Senator Cooley.
Chairman McCoy. I'm sorry I had to go for a minute and come back. In this particular bill we're looking at, does this take in consideration that maybe some of these foster homes might be in a two-story facility, might not be on a single floor? Do we address that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cooley, yes, and the 3-minute rule applies to even if it's second story, and that is the current administrative rule that the Senior Services Division has in place now. Their rules, which cover a multitude of different areas involving houses, apply both to single and two-story buildings.
Yes, go ahead.
If in the foster care homes, then is there a rule or procedure or a general understanding that those members of this foster care home that might have a handicap are for sure allocated rooms on the lower floor, for those that are more agile and able to move would be upstairs? Is that sort of in the rule somewhere, or is that sort of an unwritten rule that all providers abide by, or only those that are more conscious of those things?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cooley, that is required by the rules of SDSD that...
So on a second-story facility, those that are housed above the lower floor will be very agile and be able to get down and try to meet the 3-minute rule.
Okay. Then we'll close the hearing then.
Okay. 2305.
You just thinking right into it here.
Okay.
Any amendments?
More amendments? Subsequent referral?
No subsequent referral? Well, good.
None?
Let's move this baby out.
Okay. Senator Springer moves House Bill 2305 to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation.
Like that bill.
Discussion? None? Roll call?
Senator Cooley?
Aye.
Senator Cairns?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair McCoy?
Aye. So ordered.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
On Senate Bill 750, the interested parties went out and worked and came up with, I think, seems to be acceptable language, and works fine for me, but they want to, the ACLU wants to fly by their cooperating attorneys and return with it, if it's all right with you, for work session at our next meeting.
That's good, yeah.
All right. They like it. And gosh, I think the representative from the American Cancer Society thought it was okay, even though the ACLU wrote it. It's a hell of a deal.
Move to what?
2067.
2067.
Is it fine, Mr. Davis?
2067. Okay.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2067. Makes a number of modest changes to the dentures credentialing program, including allowing the health division to seek injunctions against persons who practice denture technology who are not licensed.
Does what about what?
Makes the makes several modest changes to the credentialing program.
Oh, I see.
Like changing the term certification to licensure.
Mixed dentures.
Yeah.
Okay. One is own. One is
right.
Own.
Okay. We have three witnesses here. We might as well have them all come on.
Yeah, I wonder who they are.
Jane Myers.
Who are they?
Susan K. Wilson.
No.
And the Honorable Jim Davis.
Two out of three.
Three's
not bad. All you need.
Dana, would you like to come? Are you speaking to this?
He's hiding.
Ms. Myers, go right ahead.
Chairman McCoy and members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association. And we're trying to stay out of making comments on this bill, but the way the A engrossed has two rather small problems, which we've talked over with Sue Wilson and Jim Davis, and I think we're all in agreement to them,
yes.
If we can present them so that the committee might understand them. On page 3 of the bill, in line 19, we think that after the parens 1, it should include a parens A, because the current law, the notwithstanding passage to the current law, refers to what is on line 2, numbered paragraph 2, but changed to paragraph A. To put it simply, what that does, my understanding is, it allows a person to come into the state of Oregon and say that they've met their educational training requirements in another way, and to provide satisfactory evidence to the health division, but they still have to do 1,000 hours of practice of denture technology, which is was paragraph 3, is now B, and perform to the satisfaction of the health division on a written and practical exam. And I think the intent of the law is to allow them to meet their educational training requirements in a different way, but still have to do the 1,000 hours and the practical exam. And so that's a technical change. Also on page 5, in line 21.
Let me ask.
Ms. Wilson, you have any problem with that first change?
No. I think when we renumbered, when Legislative Council renumbered and created a subsection A, B, and C, yeah, that was missed.
Okay.
So on 19, it should read A. Do not withstand subsection A.
1A.
Yeah, paragraph A, B, subsection
1A.
1, paragraph A.
A.
Right.
Yeah.
Page 5.
You want me to go ahead? On page 5, on line 21, we would suggest deleting the language, for which no examination shall be required. As I understand it from Ms. Wilson, that was added to make it clear that the health division wasn't going to require an additional exam to the one that's connected to the associate degree program. But it makes it a little cloudy when someone comes in and says they've done equivalent training to the associate degree program, that they may be able to argue that equivalent training doesn't mean that you have to take an exam. You could do correspondence training, for one thing, as a way of meeting the oral pathology requirement there. And I think without the language, it still allows the health division to not have to conduct an exam, but allows them to say what's equivalent to the associate degree program. If the associate degree program requires an exam, the equivalent training program must require an exam. And the reason we're making a point of it is the pathology certification or endorsement is to protect the patients of the denturist, to make sure that people who are well-trained in oral pathology are seeing them.
Did you read that line? Read D all the way through.
It starts, Mr. Chairman, up on line 13. Notwithstanding subsection 1 of the section, statements from a dentist or physician are not required. D, if the denturist providing the work has successfully completed specialized training in oral pathology,
prescribed,
and the person has applied for and received an oral pathology endorsement. Period is what you would then say.
That would be my suggestion.
Mm-hmm. It looks really clunky when you put, for which no examination shall be required. It's kind of an afterthought. Ms. Wilson.
Senator Cairns, we were trying to add clarity because we had had some conversations with the Denture Technology School. In practice, we've been requiring an examination to all those individuals who have not graduated from the Denture Technology School anyway. This was to add clarity, and it sounds like we clouded the issue. So removing "for which no examination shall be required" is fine.
Make any sense, Mr. Chairman?
No, I don't know.
What they're saying is what they're doing is simply saying you don't need the dentist or physician's statement if they've already got successfully completed specialized training in oral pathology prescribed by the health division, whether as part of an approved associate degree program or equivalent training.
Yeah. Okay.
It ought to have some commas in there, mm-hmm. And the person has applied for and received an oral pathology endorsement, period. Yep. So if you don't know those, you've got through those hoops, you don't need the doctor or dentist statement, mm-hmm. Period.
Right.
Or
the examination.
Okay.
Senator McCoy, members of the committee, my name is Susan Wilson. I'm the administrator for the Board of Denture Technology, one of those boards that is administratively linked with the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, Hearing Aid Dealers, and Electrology. This bill merely was to identify some changes in the statutes that were housekeeping. We took care of some grandfather issues. We rectified some discrepancies within the law regarding certificate renewal and restoration that Legislative Council Committee pointed out. We eliminated duplicative language for specific provisions on outdated language that pertained back again to the grandfather clause. We changed designation from certified denturist to licensed denturist, and I want to point out that by doing this, we did not change the scope of practice. We just changed the title. We clarified the qualification, or tried to clarify the qualification for issuance of denturist and oral pathology endorsement to correspond with our current practice within the health division, and we added an application fee merely to cover our costs for evaluating educational and training requirements as they are submitted to the health division. And finally, we added injunctive authority to ensure adequate consumer protection. We do have a Milton Freewater case that has been ongoing for about the last 2 or 3 years, and the person is unlicensed and causing damage to the consumer, and we need some teeth to go after that individual.
Ooh.
Honest answer.
Sore gums.
Sore gums.
Sore gums.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
To throw in something.
Let me say that the that Ms. Wilson's shop that she's running in this administratively linked organization, being an excellent model for Senate Bill 1026, we admire the work that she's done and the efficiency which has been achieved there, and also the lack of problems and all of the headaches have been ironed out. It sure is a nice operation, and it's good to see that they're here with another straight-ahead bill. Let me ask a question about that injunctive authority. You have that in other areas, in the other licensures, to actually seek injunctive relief?
Yes, we do, Senator Karen.
It's not in here?
It's not in this particular law, no.
All right.
She's Andy. They don't have it now. I'm saying they don't have it now, and they want it, and they have it for the others.
Well, let's move this.
2067.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendments on lines 19 of page 3 and lines 21 of page 5 as discussed.
Okay. Is there any objection to that motion? If not, it is so ordered.
And I'd move the bill to the floor with a new pass recommendation as amended.
Okay. So the Karen moves House Bill 2067 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? None. Is there any objection? There being none, the sword.
Thank you.
Cut out the roll.
We didn't need them.
Okay. Need guidance on 10:30.
10:30?
If we can get the just go further down.
You don't need any physical, they can do that.
Right. What we're talking about
is incorporated into the process.
That's right.
Right. So
you don't have to have $100,000.
The fiscal
report.
What
are you going to do without that?
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal report that's attached to 1030 is wrong because it parallels the one that was made on the children's impact statement, sure. And they envision a separate children's impact statement officer with a person for all of us that's
tough. We don't need all
this. We want them to go back and say, no, you got it wrong. This envisions that the current staff at LFO will add to their
duties. Right.
A statement on their fiscal impact statement, which they have to go for every bill. That if it says, yes, there's a fiscal impact, then within that fiscal impact, they've got to say, does it have a human impact, yes or no? And if it's yes, then what is it? And it's pretty easy for them to do.
Okay, so
we're not talking about new staff. We need to go back and jawbone them on the...
And doing the work.
Yeah, maybe the chair would like to talk to Mr. Trull, and Mr. Trull would like to talk to Mr. Latimer, and Mr. Latimer would like to talk to the analyst.
We will take care of that.
It's a good policy. Just where you're going to get the bucks.
Just skip all that.
We don't need bucks.
Do we need an amendment to the
bill? I don't think you should amend that. I mean, we may suggest an amendment either.
Why not?
I think they should recommend that there are certain areas that should be counseling.
With an existing staff,
that's a fiscal office. We couldn't do that.
As part of its duties in producing impact statements on bills, shall include a section on the impact statement.
You might not be able to decide to do it.
We're still on the record.
You might decide not to do it.
Yeah. See any other problems with the bill?
Did you adjourn?
No, I didn't. Yes, I thought he did.
He's been broadcast to armed forces overseas.
Yes, okay.
Did you see any?
There's no further business to come before the committee. We are adjourned.